Polycast, the official podcast of Pulp and Civilization Site, for the first time this year. With me is Daniel Quick, known on the forums as Dan Q.
I am Rand, at least you got it right this time.
I am Imran Siddiqui, your lovable and adorable co-host, and I'll say now, hi now, and we will be discussing me and Dan, apparently Mackie got lost with her admirers, and Wooter decided, well, he had better things to do, so it's just us again. Try to see if you can stay awake or not throw things at your monitor. We'll try to make this painless as possible. In our last episode 5, I guess it was, EPW said he liked it. It was really good until he fell asleep. So we did okay. Help put people to sleep.
Polycast. It's for insomniacs, too.
Yes. Now even, now in orange flavor. Okay.
What flavor were we to begin with?
You don't want to know.
There was a request. There was actually a thread started in the Polycast forum.
Oh.
One that I didn't start.
A Polycast forum? What?
You know, it's there under a Polton community, you know.
I thought we just talked about it. What the?
That we need to have more discussion on politics, religion, and sex, because civ discussion is only interesting to a point.
Well, I think he just wants to talk about sex. He wants to know Maggie's measurements.
Oh. That's right. I play on the huge map.
Bigger is better. In news, we discussed Brad Wardell on AI developed multi-core CPUs. We also discussed Sid Meier on Forbes talking about learning from video games. Soren Johnson had video game highlights of 2006. We also talked about GalCiv 2 being the best CBS of 2006 for GameSpy and eToyChest.
In the modcast, we talk about Dividing Oil, where user Von Sherma finds that Civ 4's resource system suffers once any civilization adopts free market.
In the Senate, we discussed our favorite Civ 4 legal civic. We also discussed war formulating combinations of civs for assured wars.
In the Time Machine, we look at Yin Eating Cardboard documentary from 2005. In our interview segment, Walter and I talk to Civilization 2 scenario designer Kurt Sibling some more.
First one is Wardell on AI development and multi-core CPUs at pc.ign.com about how smart the competition can get.
Yeah, so Brad wrote this article for IGN. In case you didn't know, project lead on the expansion pack Dark Avatar and the founder chief executive officer of the company that is both developing and publishing this title, Stardock Systems.
Oh, that's who he is.
Brad, it works to debunk the notion that focusing on improving on a game's artificial intelligence will not pay the same dividends as putting in the same effort on a game's appearance.
That's true.
When I'm looking at a preview or a review of a game, I mean, who wants to read when we can look at pretty pictures?
Well, I mean, and there's more. I guess it's easier to go further in graphical design than AI design. You know, you can easily show off the new graphics and how pretty everything looks, but, you know, AI is also very, very difficult, and to kind of improve the artificial intelligence further beyond, you know, make revolutionary changes to the artificial intelligence, kind of things like that, and also it's under the hood, so to speak, so, I mean, it's easier if someone sees some amazing graphical design to say, wow, that game looks really cool. So, you know, on that aspect, yeah, it definitely does seem to pay more dividends in that way. And also, I guess, you know, like you said, you know, how noticeable is a good AI? I mean, you're not going to know if you have a good AI unless you play the game for, you know, say something like GalCiv 2 or Civ 4. If you play the game multiple times, I mean, people don't know how good the AI is in Civ 4, you know, maybe until they've played, you know, at least a few games under their belt.
Exactly, because it's easy to go, ooh, graphics, shiny, where? Oh, now I'm doing it to myself. Where, as you said, as opposed to artificial intelligence, where it actually takes time and energy and effort to fully appreciate it.
Yes. It doesn't work in the ADD society we have created. How's that for your politics, Tack?
What are we talking about?
Oh, I don't know. We were talking about something?
Who are you again?
Brad goes into kind of a dual-core CPUs and now quad-core CPUs, and they can do more multi-threading, which will make, I guess, advances in AI a little bit easier to achieve or a little bit more. Well, I'm not – easier is probably not the right word, but a little bit more benefits, especially that we can see. So, but of course, not everyone has the dual-core stuff and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so if you hear the term multi-threading and you might be thinking, what, you're talking about the forums again? No. No, as much as we love to talk about the forums, actually talking about multitasking. So while you, as the human player, are doing whatever it is that you're doing, the AI is already thinking about what it's going to do on its next turn, so you don't have the waiting for other civilizations or equivalent because it's already thought about it, and perhaps it's even thinking 2, 3, 4, or X number of turns down the road.
Oh, that scares me. I can't beat you already. What the hell is wrong?
Right, but of course then the problem with that increasing complexity is that, I mean, it's great as far as gameplay goes, generally speaking, but it's going to take up more of your CPU process. But now with dual core and quad core and multi-core in general, it's not going to be so much of an issue.
And the other problem, of course, is Skynet. The reference to Terminator.
Oh, wow. I think it's the Governator now. Brad says that the challenge is not coming so much from implementing, again, the algorithms to make it complex as it is to ensuring that they use as little CPU power as possible. Dark Avatar, this is interesting, will include a CPU power slider. Mm-hmm. Where players can limit or not how much of their CPU will be dedicated to this process, and in turn, just how much smarter the AI can become. Mm. I only have a single CPU in my machine. I don't know about you, Imran.
I have dual core.
You do?
I do.
Don't look at me! Like most computer games will run faster on like a 3 gigahertz single core processor than a dual core 2 gigahertz processor of the same architecture. Because the games are incapable of efficiently using more than one core at a time. Mm. Sorry, Imran, you're just ahead of the game.
Yeah, apparently. I got it.
Ahead of the game. I'm good.
Yeah, there you go.
It's kind of like, wasn't it Windows 95? There was no point in having a hard drive larger than 2 gig, and even now in XP, there's no point in having more than 2 gig of memory because the operating system can't.
Well,
or is it 4? Yeah, you're right, 4. 4 because the systems can't see it, right, and they can't make use of it.
Yeah, unless you have a 64-bit processor or whatever, and you're running Windows 64-bit. But then again, you know, they have a compatibility problems with everything.
So I think that this is great, even despite all that Brad and Stardock are doing this because they're trying to kickstart people to take advantage of this, and that's great as long as the game itself does not suffer from those who still have single core. I mean, at some point you can't continue to support a particular platform, a particular hardware. Like trying to run Civ 4, say, on a 486?
Yeah.
No. Like at some point it's time to let go.
But, I mean, on the other hand, I guess like you're saying that you do have to support it, especially, in these type of games, which is the 4X kind of turn-based strategy type of thing. A lot of people who do play these games and, I guess a lot of the market for it are those who don't constantly update their computers. But in terms of, say, TBS, I mean, a lot of times they try to use graphics that aren't cutting-edge for the simple reason that they want to be able to keep those people who haven't upgraded their computers in quite a while. They don't try to force people to upgrade their computers to the best and brightest, because it's more about the strategy than it is about kind of like the atmosphere, and it is about the, the graphics, which add to that atmosphere. So, in terms of especially TBS stuff, you got to hold off a little bit on the dual core stuff because a lot of your market happens to be people who may not have the best and brightest, computers.
Yes, but I think now, I mean, oftentimes a discussion, of course, going or either upgrading your existing machine or getting a new one, was it need for the visuals, for the shiny?
The Shiny.
Where? The Shiny. But now, actually, there is reason to go beyond the visuals, and a good reason to upgrade may very well be to dual core or some other kind of multi-core system, mm-hmm. because you can increase the strategy, not so much your strategy, but in terms of trying to get the AI to come up to your level where it's actually responding to what you are doing with strategy as opposed to simply brute force mm-hmm. and actually, you know, thinking about next week and not just tomorrow. So like if that. I do this tomorrow...
Like I said, this is horrible. This AI is going to be better than me.
Imran's now saying, can someone create a level lower than Settler, please?
Sid Meier's was, you know, I guess gave a little interview to Forbes, learning from video games and how people learn from video computer games. The one thing I really liked from the little article they have, it's not very long, is that, you know, they heard about the guy who aced his geography class because he played pirates and knew every city in the Caribbean and every island. That actually amused me. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that was good.
And I think, playing Civilization, a lot of people learn about other civilizations that they might not have any idea about, such as, every civilization includes civs from all over the world. Some people accuse it of being a little too Eurocentric or whatnot, or, you know, a little too, you know, Americans in terms of history. But, I mean, they do a good job in adding types of civilizations that get people to kind of read up on things, such as the Mali Empire in Civ 4. I know there was a long and heated debate of which I was a part of in it about Mali should be in the game or not. So, and I'm glad it was because people, I guess, got interested in studying about it who normally wouldn't, found out about the leaders, found out about why they might have been in it. So.
Somehow that music in the background was timed so perfectly. To watch the Mali, and then all of a sudden, this music in the background.
Well, that was my cell. But, as I was saying, it definitely opens up people to different places and different strategies and different things like that. So, in terms of who these people were, and who was Mansa Musa, and who was what were the Zulus all about, really? Well, then again, I think people just like the Zulus because, you know, of various movies. But, I mean, in terms of other groups, I think it lets them read about them and study about them further on. Though I know some people were like, they don't deserve to be in. But I think other people actually did learn from the experience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, games like Civilization, yes, they have to distort reality in some cases to make it more fun. But, I mean, that's the way it should be. I mean, when was the last time you heard of a ruler living 500 years, let alone 5,000 or 6,000? But if I were to choose a single paragraph from this excerpt that best summarized his discussions, it would be this one. Quote, learning in an interactive and enjoyable environment is very effective. Your brain is really engaged and you're picking up all of this information, unquote. The only thing that I would expand on that is in picking up the information, do you understand that information as opposed to just knowing it? And I think that comes from time and interest, but if the game is of interest to you, you're reading the information, you might go to the Civilpedia for some more information, like you said, on the Mali or the Zulu, you know, if they were in there still. And then you can go online if you are so interested and find all the more about it.
Yay.
So, Sid, we learned from you learning from video games.
Yes, it's done us well. Aside, you know, we've learned from you, and then we've learned from Grand Theft Auto about how to shoot cops. So, you know, video games in general, learning experience.
And we also learned from hot coffee.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so, oh, ooh. Hey.
Ooh.
moving on. Well, Dan thinks about the hot coffee.
You're the one still talking about it, so...
Shh. Don't point it out. Soren Johnson's video game highlights of 2006.
Yeah, so CBG prefaces this interview by saying they're going to talk about the PC gaming scene, and what are we talking about in the first question? Console gaming.
video game world.
Like, I hate to admit that even if you prefer PC gaming like me, or may your soul be forgiven, console gaming, that you cannot ignore the other. I admit it's interesting, that's good to know, but blah, next question.
No, you know, when they said video game world, highlight of the video game world, I guess the next question they say the strengths of the PC platform. So when they ask about the video game world, I mean, I'm not sure they make the same distinction, you know. It seems like they consider the PC platform as part of the video game world, you know, as opposed to, say, some people who say video games and computer games are different worlds or whatnot. So I guess Soren, I guess, kind of saw them as kind of separate things, but I guess maybe the questioner was asking based on, you know, gaming in general.
I suppose, yeah. Even though they do call their site computer and video games, which if you included computer and video games, why would you distinguish between the two? But
well, the guy who did the interview may not have come up with the name.
Well, then what's he working there for? Blast you. No.
Well, what are you working at Politan for? You are not ultimate. Isn't that what it means? Or is that what we made up what it means?
Imran is now on ignore. So. Yeah. But Soren, in honor of you recognizing that the PC platform is the most flexible of any video game platform, so okay, I guess it's all inclusive, that's fine, I'll accept, move on, I hereby forgive you for giving consoles too much attention at the start of your interview.
And he also makes a point of why PC game development is suffering, because most publishers
are... Yeah, that I thought was the best part of the interview. That was a really good point.
Yes, putting all their energy and money into console development, because I guess all the money is there. And, you know, of course, which means the quality of console gaming goes up, while the quality of good, or quantity of good PC gaming goes down. I mean, you can see this. There's a lot of great games that have come out on consoles, and a lot of it has to do with because they make a ton of money there. You know, and he says there'll always be, you know, AAA PC games like Company of Heroes that remind you how great the PC gaming platform is, but even a game like Company of Heroes probably, I mean, I don't have the numbers with me, I can't say for sure, but probably didn't sell nearly as well as, say, you know, Gears of War for Xbox 360 did. So, I mean, a lot of times it comes down to money. You know, if everyone's going to chase the money, you know, it's going to be hard for great PC games to kind of come unless they're ports or, you know, I guess if some group wants to do games simply for the PC, because of their roots or because it's a more flexible platform.
Indeed, although of course you could have just made up numbers, you know, and nobody listening would have known the difference.
There are some people listening. Uh-oh. But, I mean, I also think that he's definitely right that the PC games industry needs to embrace digital distribution and have to be flexible on cost. I mean, those are that's some great advice for how the PC gaming industry can, you know, thrive in this medium right now. You know, it'll allow it to get a leg up a little bit than it has currently on console gaming. Because if you could just download the game and pay maybe $20 for it, if it's a small game, you know, I assume that there'd be a lot more sales generated and PC gaming would remain very competitive with console gaming.
I think a good idea would be to, you know, develop a title for the PC, like Civ, and then port it to the console, but have that version crippled just a little bit. Saying like, oh, do you want to actually win this game? I'm sorry, you'll have to buy the PC version.
Uh-huh. But apparently Soren is working on the perfect video game right now.
Apparently, but if you're working on the perfect video game now, what are you going to do next?
Work on
only
a PC.
Have down.
Work on the PC port for it.
I couldn't agree again more with Soren about the digital distribution question needing to be embraced more by publishers and the need for titles available through digital distribution, but they need to be priced less than their box titles. I mean, companies can still make a decent and comparable profit per unit by doing so, but, you know, look in the long run, you stand to make more money by being able, and you'll most likely sell more units anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, totally agreed on that. And you can follow the method of, I guess, what they have with the Xbox Live Arcade, which, you know, on the Xbox console, I mean, they basically sell kind of small arcadey type games for like $5, $10 or something like that. I mean, I can see like small games that maybe developers make just selling online for, you know, kind of a cheap price. And, you know, a lot of people would maybe buy something like that, a little time waster or something like that.
But you know what I really learned from reading this article?
Yes. I do not know what you learned. What did you learn?
Software that is noted for more quantity of components rather than the quality or usefulness of those components has a term for it. Shovelware. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
Oh, well, now you know. And knowing is half the battle. Maybe we should talk about GalCiv 2. My favorite game. whose sequel I know the name of all the time.
Do you really?
What the hell's the name of the sequel? The Dark Avatar?
There you go. Good for you.
Yay.
What's the full title? Galactic Civilizations 2?
Yeah, I'm reading. I have it on. I pulled up the GameSpy thing, so I know it's the Dreadlords. Otherwise, yeah.
Well, you've got the honesty virtue down pat. That's good.
Yeah, but the reason we're talking about it now is because it won Best TBS 2006 from GameSpy and eToy Chest. Yay!
Yay. You know, with the eToy Chest, I'm going to start with that one for reasons I'll make clear in a moment. The finest 4X space strategy sim ever released, I think, sums up their view perfectly. And I'll try to forget that you didn't at least have the decency to give the best game title to the best PC title. You win some, you lose some, I suppose. But with GameSpy, did you see how the discussion of GalCiv 2 was prefaced? It's one of those, well, you're the best, but...
You mean that basically the debates of the game of the year between Space Rangers 2 and GalCiv 2? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that.
We ultimately decided that Space Rangers deserve credit the better of the two games. However, I guess it's such a combination of genres that they couldn't put it for turn-based strategy. Yeah, that's kind of backhanded.
That's kind of like cheapens the acknowledgement. It was like, well, we could have, you know, given it the title because it fits into the TBS category, but good old GalCiv 2. Aww. You can't win anything else, so here you go.
All hate mail to Dan Q.
So when GameSpy says at the end, Master of Orion is dead, long live Galactic Civilizations 2, The next sentence that they didn't type was probably long rule Space Rangers 2.
Well, they gave Space Rangers 2, they rated as their fourth best game, PC game of the year, too. So.
And to complete my proof of that sentence, where is GalCiv 2 on the top 10 PC list?
Number 6.
Ta-da!
Not very far off, though. So, I mean, I guess they thought very highly of it this year, which is good. Company of Heroes won Best PC Game. So Company of Heroes once again thwarts GalCiv 2 and Space Rangers. Damn those real-time strategy peoples.
Yes, except Rise of Nations fans.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry. We have a real-time strategy game on our site? Uh-oh. All right, gotta take back all that stuff.
If you have any news for us, any news tips, contact us with news tips.
Head on over to apolton.net/about, look for Contact Us, or news@apolton.net also works.
And you can also PM.
Yes, you can. Milcutis, Dan Q, Snoopy369, and Illuminatus, one of us four, we'll get that up there.
There's dividing oil, dividing resources. Not just oil, but I guess just in terms of any resources, huh?
Yeah, oil was kind of the one held up as the key example, probably because, you know, it's a later game discovery and its keyness.
Yeah.
So you have user Von Sharma finds that Civ War's resource system suffers once any civilization adopts free market, you know, let alone being forced to do so through a certain UN resolution. But that's another discussion.
Foreshadowing.
He says that if all oil deposits are outside your cultural border, you do not have it. Yet, quote, any country can obtain it on the world market as long as there is no active embargo imposed on the country. Okay, unquote. Yes, any country can obtain it, but it's not automatic, nor should it be. You have to bargain for it in the real world, and that translates well to game strategy. Whoa, strategy. Who would have thought, huh?
Strategy in the real world.
I mean, you know, good luck. You could say, well, you could demand that resource, but oil is a strategic resource, and you likely needed to have it in the first place to put yourself in a position to demand anything. So I don't think that works.
And there's also a fun gameplay versus reality argument here as well. I guess you could try to split it off and, you know, divide it up or whatnot. But, you know, by having these resources and having them on certain tiles, it creates tensions along borders for these resources. And I guess that's one of the reasons why they're there. I mean, they create conflict and presumably create warfare because of these resources that might be on one tile over on someone else's cultural borders. So I think it's a gameplay idea. I mean, if you divided the oil, wouldn't have as much, I guess, power to kind of create warfare or whatnot.
Yeah, because in this argument, oh, well, you know, if you choose not to join free market, that's fine. But once you do, your oil would be available to other countries on the free market. Well, yes, again, it is available, but it's not necessarily that you're going to get it just because you joined free market. It kind of goes back to the problem that we have with the United Nations, is that the United Nations is built. Everybody is suddenly belonging to the United Nations. There is no choice to either not join at the beginning or maybe petition to get in later or get out of it. Yeah. And apparently, I don't know about you, but originally I was with Raw, where apparently I misunderstood his idea, because Von Sharma's idea, because I thought, you know, can we do this already? Can we not trade a resource for another resource or coin?
Mm-hmm.
But apparently what he's getting at is finite resources like we first and only saw in Civ 3, and then trading pattern differences between earlier times and older resources, such as iron, and modern times and newer resources like oil. But as you said, that goes all back to the gameplay elements. I don't think we should go here. Even if we could find a way not to make this a micromanagement headache, it still seems to be a bit too much. That even if there is automation of certain things, you're going to have to take that into consideration, and I think it's going to take away from the fun factor just a little too much.
Yeah, I mean, for if you're including a free market type of thing, I mean, you couldn't just put oil, of course, and you'd have to create a whole nother level to the game, a whole nother economic, I guess, veneer on top of it, which might be a little bit too, I guess, time-consuming for any expansion pack or whatnot, and may also take out some of the fun of the game, make it a little bit too tedious in the end part of the game. Yes, it's simple. It's very simplified, but I mean, a lot of things in Civ are very simplified, and they do it because it's more fun that way. So, I mean, I don't think I would agree with Von Sharma's proposal here, just because while it would be a little more realistic, it would probably be a little bit more tedious as well, and, well, we don't need any more tediousness.
No. No, and I think I know I'm not a fan of, you know, people who start something and don't finish it, but I'm going to actually, you know, kind of take what he said, some of the things that he has proposed to get to what he's talking about, you know, I think should be back, like finite resources. Getting finite resources back, I think, is a good idea, as long as it's implemented properly. As someone pointed out, the problem in Civ 3 is all of a sudden it's gone, but there's been absolutely no warning. You know, perhaps you could have a little pop-up noting that, you know, deposits of X are running low.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else pointed out, okay, but if you're going to have finite resources, then we need to have better seeding of resources in the game. Like, I've played a number of games on, you know, like smaller size maps because I want to get into the conflict a little sooner. I don't want to just be, okay, that's seem like I got to build another city in order to get a little closer to someone, just to piss them off a little more, you know, get to their borders. Let's get on with it. But aluminum in particular can be a bugger to find.
Yeah.
You know, so then you don't have aluminum, it never shows up on the map, then you've got no modern tanks, fighters, bombers, etc.
Yep.
Did you also notice the argument in the thread that one source of oil, or indeed any resource, should not be enough to power an entire army? I think that's a pretty oversimplification, and I know we talk about simplification for, you know, fun's sake, but first of all, what size of army are we talking about? Because my idea of what an army should be and what your idea of an army and a navy and an air force could be very different.
Exactly. And, you know, of course, you know, we're simplifying one thing of oil. I mean, before Civ 3, I guess, you mean, you know, you didn't need any resources to build units or to build armies and things like that. And the addition of resources, you know, as required you to have them. I mean, I think it's a little bit too, well, I don't think it'd be a good idea to say, well, you need X amount of oil resources to produce a unit force of X. I think that would get into the same problems I said before, get too tedious, you get too bogged down in numbers, and it just, you know, the fun would be gone. It'd be more like, you know, trying to, instead of just having a fun little game, you'd have, you know, something more like work.
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of sounds like when you get into particulars like that, so it's like, okay, I have an iron resource. This will give me X swordsmen and Y pikemen. Or wait, is it X pikemen and Y swordsmen? I'm so confused. You know, I mean, that just sounds like a spreadsheet game, but who wants to play that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, some people, I guess, do, but, you know, they can buy imperialism if they want to do that. All hate mail to me, I know. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree. I mean, this is just the classic argument, once again, of, you know, realism versus, you know, simplification and, you know, abstraction of that sort. So there is a balance between the two, and I think this might throw the balance a little out of whack.
Yes. Good in theory, absolutely. But in practice, not so much.
Too much micromanagement.
I suppose if you really like all that micromanagement kind of stuff, you know, the software development kit is pretty powerful. Maybe someone can go in and come up with something so that if micromanagement is your thing, you like micromanagement, you like that, is it good for you, then you can do that. But as a general gameplay rule, rules and whatnot and mechanics, just leave it be.
Leave it be.
Favorite Civ 4 Legal Civic?
Well, my favorite Legal Civic. It's nice to have free speech with all that commerce flowing in. That's kind of cool. I usually like that. I mean, I generally tend to be a builder anyway, and I like to see all that money rolling in from towns, and I like all that culture as well. Culture is fun.
Yes. Now, Imran, have you built towns within your city borders?
I have.
Good. So you actually planned.
Ooh.
Amazing.
Oh. I plan.
Good for you.
I plan. I build you know, cottages very early and, you know, with the view that they will build up to be economic powerhouses in the towns with their extra commerce with free speech. You know, I normally don't get into all that many wars or try not to, so I don't do nationhood as much, though. I mean, nationhood is a very nice war type of thing. Bureaucracy, of course, is used, I guess, when the slingshot was in vogue. I guess with the changes, it's little bit more difficult.
Yeah, I think, you know, bureaucracy could be more of a shorter-term solution, but, you know, generally, even any extended period of anarchy is probably not worth it. But I think it's worth adopting where maybe you only have a handful of cities for whatever reason. You know, you're on a smaller map or you got, you know, squeezed into a very small space for whatever reason. But your capital needs to be a fair size, although generally speaking, I think most people's capitals are a fair size.
Yeah.
But I think if your capital already has a notable number of workable tiles that have manufacturing and financial potential and capabilities, really don't see the point with bureaucracy. Now, you mentioned nationhood. Yeah, definitely with military advantages in mind in the longer term. I think you'll appreciate the +2 happiness from barracks if you're drafting citizens in your cities. Every time you turn around... Get it? Turn around and turn. I'm good.
What are we hanging
or bad
about now?
And the upkeep is also nil. Whereas in the shorter term, vassalage, I mean, yes, its upkeep is high. So unless you're playing on Always Peace, but why would you, Imran?
Who, me?
I think that the increased unit experience points and lower support costs can be universally appreciated.
So free speech for you mostly as well, or?
Yeah. I would say so. As long as you plan for it.
Well, sure.
I mean, yes, with the cultural benefit can be helpful to you, whether you're leading, averaging, or especially, I suppose, even if you're behind in this category, especially by the time free speech becomes available. If that's a problem. Oh, I hope your neighbors think the same way you do and that culture is for the pits. But at the same time, even if you haven't planned for towns, you can change them later on. You can get rid of those farms if you want.
That's true.
And of course, we mentioned in an earlier podcast that I'm more of a farm person. I guess I think about, yes, the economic advantages later on of having towns when the cottages grow to be towns. But I think about, okay, if I want additional income, if I'm not going to get that from trade, then I'll get that from having specialists in the city once I max out.
Mm.
Although at the same time, I guess that's kind of showing that I generally play on the lower difficulty levels because you get to the higher difficulty levels, and for some reason, people talk about it being crowded. What?
No, hey.
Where's the closeness in our society? Where does it go? Where did it all go wrong?
Oh. When did it all go right?
I don't know. I think we can all agree that if you like to stick to barbarism, even when you can switch to another legal civic, either you don't know what you're doing,
but Dan, there's low upkeep.
Well, considering you get no benefit, I think that's too much upkeep.
Well, that's true. Mm.
So if you like barbarism, don't talk to my face. Talk to the hand.
Mm. Good stuff.
Wars formulating and combination of civs for assured wars. Wanderer
27
asks, are there certain combinations for civs that will war? It's a little awkwardly phrased. I think he was a little too excited about the topic. I didn't check for grammars. What he was getting at is that it seems that no matter what he does, everyone, even if they're annoyed with one another, will not actually go the next step and go to war with one another. That everyone just seems quite content with being passively pissed off at everyone. So he was saying, what can I possibly do to change this? And he didn't take kindly to some suggestions, could be interpreted. Read the thread for yourself. But outside some of the obvious, the through world builder suggestions, I mean, yes, those can help. I know it's not cheating, but it kind of is, but it isn't. Send all hate mail to some, to, oh, send all hate mail to Edward Mackey, who didn't make it.
Yay!
One of the world builder suggestions, I guess I'll mention it, not to, you know, verify it or justify it in any way, but having an initial strength imbalance where you go in and give one particular AI a couple more settlers or a couple more workers than somebody else. And you go to another part of the world, you know, depending upon the map size, and do the same thing, some kind of combination thereof. Other than that, I think the big thing, if you're finding that, and I read that, is you need to play on a higher difficulty level. Warlord or higher, because at settler or even chieftain, you get a lot of that kind of passive piss-off-ness.
Mm.
That should be a word. Another thing you can do is you can select aggressive AI when setting up a game, and if you're feeling really ambitious, you could select always war. If you're looking for fights, not just joining a fight or seeing other civs fight, but if you want to be involved and hated by all, then choose this option because, of course, the AIs are united against you.
Well, screaming through the thread. Yeah, the one thing that Wanderer, and I don't understand it too much, but, I mean, he complains that there aren't enough AI wars, but it doesn't seem that he wants to get involved in the wars. You know, he wants them to fight each other. I guess he wants them to weaken each other, weaken themselves so he can swoop in and take what's left. He complains, I guess, about his expansion is at a standstill and research is at a crawl because he's fighting off all the barbarians because he played on noble difficulty instead of whatever difficulty he was playing on. I don't know if you could have it both ways. You know, the barbarians, as mentioned in the thread, lead to other AIs having larger militaries, which they may use against each other if the need arises. And I think one of the things is that on the lower difficulty levels, yes, the AIs don't usually fight too much at all. But on the higher ones, you're going to see a lot more conflict and violence, and especially barbarians and you know, civs getting into it with each other, you know, being more aggressive. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what he actually wants.
Yeah, because he's kind of like wanting cake and eating it too. I know. Mm-hmm. Did he also mention that he wanted to be able to watch? Like, how can I watch other AIs fighting each other? Well, I think that wasn't that. That was a big problem. I would in earlier Civ titles, Civ 3 and before, is that unless you turn those off, those, you know, watch enemy moves, your turns could be really, really long. As you, I mean, if you want to watch people kick each other's butt, then why don't you turn on the TV or rent a movie or something?
Damn, I'm disappointed in you though.
Why is that?
I was expecting you to say, "Do you like to watch?" But
oh well, just for you then. Do you like to watch? Do you like that? Is that good for you?
I'm never going to be able to explain this away now. I don't know. I mean, apparently he said he'll just in the original post he said maybe he'll just shelve this and go to Civ 4, or Civ 3. I'm sorry. So apparently he has played Civ a bunch before, but I mean the way that he's writing his post seemed to be that he's very new to the game or. He's just playing it on very low difficulties. I'm not sure what I can tell the man or the woman, aside from just play it on, you know, noble difficulty levels is a good one to play it on to kind of find out, you know, what the AI does and how to deal with it. Civ 4 is a vastly different game than Civ 3 was. It has a lot more concepts, a lot more complex, and, you know, you do have the AIs end up fighting each other on the harder difficulty levels. They tend to be more aggressive overall. And also, you can put Isabella in and, well, you know, let the fun begin.
I noticed that Totila Hun suggests founding two early religions and spreading them to differing sides. And Wanderer 27 says, well, I find myself founding pretty well all religions, and I think that was a pretty good indication that we are on a low difficulty level.
Otherwise, there's no way you'd be able to find all that many if you were on a higher one other than the, you know, first two.
Yeah, and I founded more than one religion, early religion, a number of times, not that many. And actually what I would do even when I was playing on the lower difficulty levels, I know it's kind of a long-running joke, and rightfully so, that, I mean, I played on Chieftain, and then Settler for a while, but now I'm about 50-50 on Warlord and Chieftain. Yay for me!
I thought you were going to say, no, I'm 50-50 on Settler and Pre-Settler. That's when you get to play in the sand and no one bothers you.
Doesn't anyone want to fight with me?
Whoa.
Aww. I'll kick sand in your face.
But,
thank you. The sand is blocking out that bright sunlight. It's very thoughtful. But as I said, I've founded more than one early religion a number of times, and even when I could found multiple ones after that, I would purposely not do that.
Mm.
As originally as a strategy, because, well, then that's just going to make this game too easy, because then everybody is going to like me. Relatively, at some point. Although,
which is different from real life.
You would
know.
But what I found amusing is that when I found two early religions, I would adopt one and I would spread one through my own cities, through missionaries, and then, of course, sending missionaries elsewhere. But then I would see my other religion, spread to some other civilizations, and they would adopt them. So I couldn't help but find it amusing that in diplomacy with those civilizations that have adopted my other religion, that, you know, they're getting on me for adopting a heathen religion, but I didn't even get credit for founding that religion in the first place. I mean, sure, I usually adopt and stick with theocracy until if and when I'm forced to abandon all religions through a certain UN resolution. But still, you know, just because I adopt theocracy and say no other religion can spread doesn't mean that you have to hate me so much. I mean, I founded it. Shouldn't that be good enough?
They like to hate you.
They're into that sort of thing, I guess.
Apparently. Time Machine Island on December 27, 2005. We had the amusing little video, Yin Eating Cardboard. I enjoyed it very much so, as I think anyone who saw it will always remember it, and, well, I guess it also proves how Civ 4 really did succeed, you know, in its goals of reducing reliance on ICS, and totally, I guess, resulting in other strategies having been used. And we get the bonus of Yin cutting up a cardboard box, putting it in an English muffin, eating it, and throwing it up. Ah, that's good video.
And for those of you who are acronym challenged, ICS refers to Infinite City Sprawl.
Oh, yeah, right.
This public service message is brought to you by someone who hasn't heard himself talk for 10 seconds. Yeah, so I think Yin has become quite famous or infamous, depending upon your view, as a result of this documentary, if not for making the
list.
For not making the promise that he would eat the cardboard box.
Oh, yes, that's right. There was that.
You know what? I think it's to Yin we can thank Firaxis for getting rid of that problem, because they're probably going to leave it in, and then they saw, oh, Yin's going to eat a cardboard box? That is so worth it.
I wonder if it's made it to YouTube yet.
No, I haven't seen it on YouTube, but I have seen it on Google Video.
Oh. Well, there you go.
I remember it was just after Christmas. I was about to say last year, because that's not true anymore. It's in 2005. And Yin says, okay, I put this video together. I went through it. Yes. Enjoy. Put it up whenever you like. And in less than 24 hours. And he was thinking, oh, no, I was hoping I'd have some time to adjust.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
No. I have to admit, the first time I watched it, when we actually got to the gagging scene,
yeah.
I looked away.
Oh, Dan, he's like, nah, with his weakness.
But I think some more academic topics on that particular video have not been discussed. For example, the jam that he chose, strawberry, I believe. Why did you rule out blueberry and raspberry?
Is he biased? Or,
I don't know. What's wrong? Why didn't you have a mixed berry where every berry is included?
You
discriminate against berries. And then, of course, there's marmalade and peanut butter going, hello. One other thing that I noticed while reading through the Chronicles of Civilization book that comes with Civilization Chronicles, although not mentioned by name or where it can be downloaded from, that's the real tragedy, but it is mentioned.
Yay.
About a fan eating a cardboard box as a sign of people's dedication to the game.
We've proven our critics wrong. I don't know. Next time, I don't think he'll make such claims. It didn't look very pleasant to eat a cardboard box.
No. And there was nothing that said he couldn't have a drink of something with him.
Well, that's true. I mean,
that was just silly.
Something like that requires some alcohol. Though I also have to say it was a very well-done movie.
The music was appropriate.
The cinematography was decent.
It showed how evil Marcos really was. Mm-hmm. Finally, the world got to see what I already knew.
It's a travesty. It wasn't nominated for Best Documentary. Best Short Film.
Gem in the Rough.
Yep.
Gems. Ooh.
Oh.
A tie-in. Wouter and I are back, concluding our interview with Civilization 2 scenario designer Kurt Sibling. So, Kurt, why are you and other Civ 2 scenario makers still making Civ 2 scenarios when there are so many other newer games out there that give you more power to do what you want? Like Civ 4, for example, is being lauded as the most moddable Civ game to date, and before that, Cult Power Series.
There's more than one answer. It really depends who you ask. I mean, everyone has got their own reasons for sticking with Civ 2 in the community. I mean, one is obviously kind of brand loyalty. Well, a lot of people just say, look, Civ 2 is the best, damn it, and I'm not moving. Which, yeah, absolutely, and I'm probably in that bracket myself. But don't get me wrong, I mean, Civ 3, Civ 4, amazing games. I would say that Civ 2 is most... It harkens back to a time where it was easier to mod. Civ 4, I do have it, and it is an awesome game, and I probably will end up modding it at some point in the future, but right now... There's just something charming about Civ 2. There's something about its old world feel, I guess, is the best way to describe it. I think because a lot of people have a lot of good memories attached to Civ 2, that is why they kind of hardcore stick to it, because it's still I would say, I mean, these new games with amazing graphics, amazing amounts of work put into them, Civ 2 just still has that simplicity. It still has something that I don't think any other game has. It harks back to the late 90s when games were just... I guess games. I mean, I'm thinking games like Daggerfall, games like Gunship 2000. Now, I know people are going to say, oh, listen to him with his nostalgia here. But it's the fact that Civ 2 still works on XP. It still is readily moddable, and the window just keeps getting pushed with it. I mean, if you looked at the graphics, say, 5 years ago, and then compared it to what's going on now, people would say, crikey, look how good those graphics are. You wouldn't think it was possible. I mean, I used to think Nemo's graphics, amazing though they were for the time. I thought that was as far as you could take it. That was it. We'd reach the zenith. But no, it's, I mean, there's guys on Apolloton that are really, every time you release a graphics set, it's just wow. Later games can add graphics, but, and they can add, lots of new dynamics to it, but I think Civ 2, the same cliche, has stood the test of time. I would say it's one of those games that is a true classic. I think I wonder if any of the games companies could use a speech like that. That's a, what's the term? One more turn. I think that is the thing that sums up Civ 2. Basically, yeah. I think that is probably its most enduring quality. Yep. But,
okay. Yeah. You have played Civ 4. You were even involved in the testing group.
Oh, yeah.
You abandoned that again. What do you think of Civ 4? How do you think it worked out, and why did you abandon it in the end?
Oh, well, I've not really abandoned Civ 4. I mean, I have it on my hard disk, and I was very happy to get my signed copy from Sid Meier himself, which was a treasured item. I would say Civ 4 worked out. I mean, watching it in development was very interesting. All these veterans all putting their minds together. It was like, I thought it was like the Manhattan Project of Civ. It was incredible, creating this ultimate game. I would say that what I loved about the Civ 4 development was the fact that the developers were so open to ideas. It wasn't a case of, we're going to do our thing. They were totally open and they implemented things. That impressed me. I would say Civ 4 is truly a great game. It's looking at it as a kind of game, I've seen all kinds of people play it. Non-strategy people can leap right in and get started. And before you know it, they're sending tanks through people's territories and everything. It's good to watch. I would say Civ 4, it's not a problem with Civ 4, it's a problem with new games in general, that they're just getting too damn big. Games are becoming massive, gigs and gigs of space, and I just think there's a trend, obviously, within computers in general that causes that. I don't know, it doesn't have the simplicity. But, I give Civ 4 total thumbs up. It's just, I am really stalwart for Civ 2, and I think both games are great, but I wouldn't abandon Civ 2 for Civ 4. And even if I did start modding in Civ 4, I'd probably do it in Civ 2 as well. I don't see the two as needing to be completely loyal to one or the other. I think yeah, both are good for what they are.
So if Sid asked you to design Civ 5 and would give you complete freedom to make it whatever you wanted it to be, what would you do with it? Where would you take it in terms of gameplay?
I'd make it into a big Civ 2 World War II scenario. No. I would actually... I think what I would do is, what a lot of people would like is more eras. I wouldn't break up the eras in that you have to... I would try and find this middle ground between an era of history being sort of amorphous, that it doesn't say, this is a medieval era you're in, incidentally, because nobody called it a medieval era at the time. It was only called that by future generations. So what I would do is, I would have the game dwelling in a certain area, and you can tell the era you're in based on your technology. Obviously, because a lot of people love the Renaissance era, and they love the 1600s, 1800s, Napoleonic era, and all those eras. I would try and make the game kind of dwell on the cool aspects of each of those eras. Like Napoleonic era, there'd be a lot of sort of musket warfare, but I wouldn't turn it just into a war game. Obviously, there'd be a lot of... I would basically build on everything that I've seen in Civ. I mean, obviously, there'd be... One thing I wouldn't do is have it in a Rome Total War way where it zooms onto a battlefield, because I think Civ has always been quite courageous. The Civ developers have always been quite heroic in the way that they've
you're stuck to basically you're stuck to the top-down view. They've never given to the Age of Empires type thing. I mean, Age of Empires, great game, people love it, but it's not Civ, and there was a Call to Power, I remember, had a neat little system where it zoomed into a mini battlefield. I wouldn't even implement that. I would keep Civ the way people like it. Just stacks of units on the board, like a board game, and just move them around. I mean, there's a ton of things you could change. I would obviously strengthen the religion aspect, and I would strengthen I would make the political aspect a bit like the religion aspect in Civ 4, where you can spread maybe political power of a certain type, like capitalism and communism spreading around. That would be an interesting aspect. I'd add a really big scenario designer or design tool to it, where you could basically just make it as easy as it was in Civ 2 to make a scenario. Yeah, I mean, that'd be cool. Sid Meier phoning me up saying, do you want to design Civ 5? And I thought, well, me and my own? How the hell am I going to do all the graphics? Wait a minute. Take me 100 years, actually. Do the work with 50 people. Yeah, but
presumably you would be able to hire some people.
I'd be calling you guys first. Don't worry.
All right.
See, right, you do all the modelling, I'll do all the animation, and I've been involved in games developing actually for the BBC in the past. I do know is making a game is a very hard process, and actually at the end of the Civ 4 development, you could see the guys were really, the grind was starting to show. A lot of the guys were doing like obviously 48 hours straight almost, I think, just drinking Red Bull in between, and that was near the, I've been in that space myself. I've worked on two games before, and I know what it's like when the creative director says, look, guys, we're going to have to do an all-nighter here, we're going to have to stay in all night and work, the deadline's tomorrow, and then it's just, you just have to go for it. So a lot of people in public don't appreciate the games, they all think it's a group of guys sitting around just eating pizza and having fun. There is an aspect of that, but it is damned hard work. I think I've digressed, haven't I, onto something. Sorry, feel free to ask that question.
Okay.
I was just pondering it openly.
And with such a Civ 5, how would you ensure that it had the same kind of vibrant and big modern community that Civ 2 did? You already sort of mentioned
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, again, I would make sure the tools are so easy that I would make a really easy-to-use interface tool that you could basically get a save game and just change it so easily, then just save it as a scenario file. No, I mean, I know Python is a system people use, and it is easy, but it's not accessible to the complete layman off the street. I mean, if I showed it to somebody who'd never seen Python before, they'd be like, what's going on? Because Civ 4 has got such a powerful system, such powerful graphics, and I think, I mean, already the mod community is pretty amazing for Civ 4, but I think, events and adding in, just creating something. I mean, I've seen World War II scenarios on Civ 4, and they seem quite, I don't know, the map doesn't seem big enough somehow. I don't know what, it's hard to describe. You've only got like four cities in Britain, and if you get a map any bigger than that, in World War II, you've got Europe, or any European scenario, you need a lot of cities in Europe, because there's a lot of countries in Europe. And basically, you'd need a tremendously big map. But the problem is, with a game like Civ 4, once you get a huge map, you're going to need a huge computer to basically run it, unless you want to go and have a cup of tea every time you take a turn and come back an hour later. My main thing for any Civ 5 scenario making would be just a really well-designed tool that is a kind of auxiliary program that basically enables you to change things right there and then just save it as a scenario and upload it. Just like the way Civ 2 does, really, only with obviously the advantages of more modern programming and technology. It'd be good to have a system, a bit like the Civ 2 scenario maker, where you just had a drop-down menu that you could make tech trees, you could make whatever way that game implemented its tech tree or its units, you could just plonk units onto the map, you could rename cities, you could implement new graphics. If you have graphics in a folder, for instance, you could browse into that folder and replace all the cities with a different graphics set. I mean, I'm a believer that you could create something that the everyday person could use and create really good scenarios with.
So you would definitely prefer a simpler approach, but that gives you less power as a modder over approach that's more complex, like Civ 4, but that allows you to do a lot more things.
I would reverse that and try and find a simple approach that gives you the same power. That is, I mean, I've got no problem with the way Civ 4 is implemented with scenarios and mods just now. I think it's great, but I think it could be even easier for people. I mean, it would really help the mod community as well to have so many new people jumping in. That's what keeps this community going, is like tons of new faces and tons of new blood. That would be, if I'm sure it's possible. Maybe for Civ 5. I mean, you don't know what changes are on the way with Vista and all the other upgrades to Windows, and you don't know what the future holds. I would like to give the power that Python gives you to make mods and put it in a way that makes it easy for someone who's never even done any modding before to pick it up and learn quickly. Just a simple tool, but it gives you a lot of power.
This discussion was very much a part of Polycon 06 back in July. Very, very lively discussion, and I think we could talk about this for a long, long time. But a related question, the line between a professional and an amateur modder has been blurring for a few years now, as good amateurs are hired and their work is released in official games and expansions. Where do you see modding going in the future? Do you think we'll see more of this?
I would say a lot of modding is obviously influenced these days by a lot of things going on. I mean, when I work in university, I see this. I see young people who are sitting watching movies of the new Halo or the new Oblivion game, and you never had it to this degree. A lot of influences are coming from other genres like manga or whatever's cool as a movie or TV. I mean, I notice there's other big games like Warcraft and other themes. These obviously give a lot of people a lot of inspiration and ideas. They say, hey, let's make a Civ scenario featuring these characters, because young people do get inspired, and even older modders like myself, I see a lot of themes. I get a lot of ideas from. I mean, obviously, I usually harken back to history or the themes that I know, but I would say the way modern will go, it really depends on what kind of technology, and as I mentioned earlier, what kind of tools are made available to the public. Back in the late 90s and mid-90s, we never had this huge plethora of cultural stuff going on. Back in the mid-90s, there's such a huge wave of cultural influence hitting younger people now, and I think that will keep the mod community going for quite a long time. The way things are going just now, you'll see a lot more people getting into Python, and there's a lot of people who will become the new kind of big names in modding. There's already a lot of guys out there that are very impressive skills. I mean, one of the big things that's moving into is the 3D animation. There's a lot of guys out there who have really got their heads around 3D modelling and animation, and that is a totally new sort of aspect to it that's getting added in quite readily now. But I would say 3D modelling and animation will play a bigger and bigger part in modding. That is one thing you're going to see. The rise of it has already begun. I would say the things you'll see in the next couple of years will be very impressive. They'll basically recreate Civ 4 itself, and they might actually even exceed the graphics. Ultimately, I think that's what will happen. As people get to grips with how to add in your own content, sky's the limit. Sky will definitely be the limit for Civ 4.
We move from Civ to podcasting. As you know, this interview is part of Polycast, Appleton's official podcast. A few questions under this branch, quick-fire ones. Have you listened to any previous shows?
Actually, recently I did, I will admit my podcast knowledge is quite limited now, but I do think I'll be checking out most of Apolliton's stuff, especially here, this as well, see what... cut that bit out. Basically, it's one of these aspects of the site that I'm still really to get immersed into fully, but now, looking at it, I think, you can rate them, so I'll be making sure... I'll be rating my own as atrocious, of course, as soon as I get a kiss. Nah, I'm only kidding. No, it does look very interesting, yeah.
So you haven't listened to any other podcasts
not
yet?
Not really many.
Well, there's no point. You only need one, and that's this one.
Of course. Yeah, that's true.
So you've listened to some Polycast episodes in the past. Who's your favorite co-host? It's probably Mackie because of her voice, right? You know, Mackie has a lot of dates. She has a lot of fans out there. Were you on a date last week? That's why she wasn't here, I hear. When we recorded the last episode.
I can account for all of my movements in the last month. No, it wasn't me. I'm actually on a Polyton right now. I noticed a man called Dan Q's on it. I wonder who he could be. Makalua? Is this? I would say my favorite hosts are probably you guys, Makalua and Dan. They're the people. Yep. Is that a good enough endorsement?
No, I feel left out.
And don't forget Wouter. Yeah, who could forget? He's a man.
Thank you for your time. It was a great interview.
Thank you very much. And it's been a great pleasure to do this podcast with Polyton.
Yes, thank you for joining us and being such a loyal member of the Polyton community.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, and look forward to meeting you guys online.
If you have any questions for us, you can send them to, what was it, Dan?
Polycast@apolton.net. That's polycast@apolton.net.
And if you really want to humor us, send us a voicemail, and we will play it on the air.
Reach us through our Skype account, the Polycast, by using Skype yourself. The call is free. Download Skype from skype.com, skype.com. You can also phone us if you prefer. In North America, call 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, call 44-20-7871-7659. That's 44-20-7871-POLY. No profanity or hate mail, please. This week's choice select of spam comes from an idiot. Dear Life Producer, there has never been a better time to have our product in your marketing arsenal. We have been servicing financial professionals like you since 1998. Let's see, where do I begin? First of all, financial professionals. If you're looking at a Polyton as a business, we're not very good. And then the first part of this Dear Life Producer, are you suggesting I have a lot of illegitimate children I don't know about? What?
No.
What kind of introduction is that?
It's even worse. He's suggesting you have a life.
Next time, and then there was one.
And then there was one. Yeah. Fun spam. All right.
I think that is a wrap.
Good job. I'm talking
Thank
to myself.
Thank you for joining me.
We'll be coming back on many different occasions this year, every couple of weeks, hopefully. So yay for you. You get to put up with us. 2007 looks to be a banner year for a Polycast. I was joined today by Dan Quick.
Hi again.
And I am Imran Siddiqui. Imran Siddiqui on the forums. Dan Quick is Dan Q on the forums. And we both sound alike. So who was saying what and who took what positions, you will never, ever really know.
Yeah, so what's your handle on the forums again, in case people forgot?
What is it now? My handle on the forums is Dis. No. I'm Imran Siddiqui on the forums.
It could be worse.
That's true.
And we'll try not to sound like one another either.
Keep saying A a lot.
Or maybe we will.
Just to confuse people. Was that me or was that you? I think everyone's turned off by now.
I doubt they were ever turned on. Record date January 6, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV and the Warlords Expansion Pack. Copyright 2007 of Polyton Civilization site at Polyton.net.